If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for spending part of your Saturday with me. I'm super grateful to you for that. Lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch show. We're going to be talking about some tech-related injuries, new injuries that did not exist a decade ago. We're going to be talking about that. We're going to also be talking about a startup that has just seen some very, very big, big changes this week in the news. And, of course, we will be talking about all kinds of other stuff in the headlines in the business world. But starting us off, our good friend Greg Trotter is with us, and he's a business reporter covering the food industry for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for being with us today. So there are changes coming with food assistance and food stamps and government assistance programs concerning who can buy what and what they can buy and access to food and all of that good stuff. So help us catch us up on all of that that's going on.
Sure. Yeah. So these are proposed changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, which is the federal food stamps program. So right now, this is a proposed change. It's under review, and it's going to be final before the end of the year. But basically, it seeks to double the variety of required stock of healthy foods, so fruits and vegetables, protein, dairy, bread. So right now, all SNAP retailers, this could be, you know, anything from a corner store, convenience store, grocery store, Walmart, the required minimum is they have to have three varieties in each of the four staple food groups. So three varieties of fruits and vegetables, meat, dairy, bread. And under the proposed changes, it would double, more than double that to seven varieties. And they would have to have 6 units of each variety. And they would, and some of that would have to be perishable. They would have to have perishable food in 3 of the 4 categories. So, bottom line, it's doubling the amount of nutritious food. And my story was looking at what impact this would have in corner stores in some of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods. Many of them are SNAP retailers that accept food stamps, and oftentimes they don't have fresh fruits and vegetables. So this is sort of controversial. Convenience stores have pushed back, saying that this is going to challenge their retailers. There's not enough space. They don't have the storage. They don't have the distribution set up. And so there's been some pushback. So that's what's under review right now.
Certainly. Well, it's usually when we start talking about this, the usual first kind of line of pushback is, why regulate what people eat? But this really isn't about regulating what people eat. This is about offering more options.
That's right.
And so No other options are going to be eliminated. Things that are currently part of the SNAP program and foods identified as SNAP eligible won't necessarily be eliminated as options.
Well, actually, another part of the proposed changes that the National Association of Convenience Stores is opposed to is under the proposed change, if 15% or more of your sales are from food that's cooked or heated on premise, then you can't participate in the food stamp program. And so when you think about convenience stores that, you know, maybe they have hot dogs or whatever heated food they have, you know, that they're offering, but a lot of convenience stores also have restaurants in them. And so under this proposed change, they wouldn't be able to accept food stamps. And so that's a big one that I think, you know, we'll see. That could be tweaked, though, before the rule becomes final.
Sure. And so the pushback that you mentioned from small stores that aren't necessarily under this, cafe serving hot food kind of banner, is this about cost? Is this about having to handle, refrigeration and things like that in different ways or in bigger ways, having more equipment to handle those? Or is there other specific things attached to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are different barriers. I mean, if you're talking about some of these corner stores in some of Chicago's low-income neighborhoods on the south and west side, I mean, the Cook County Health Department has studied this. They're doing work in corner stores. You know, their research has found that particularly corner stores in predominantly African American communities in the South suburbs. You know, most of their research was in suburbs. Found the corner stores in African American communities are far less likely to have fresh fruits and vegetables. And I talked to an Inglewood corner store owner or manager, excuse me, and he was saying that, you know, look, we sell fresh fruits and vegetables, but nobody buys it. And so that's part of the work that some of the nonprofits are doing in Chicago right now, is helping these stores market and promote the fresh fruits and vegetables and proteins and everything that are helping, you know, going in the stores, doing samples, giving out recipes, trying to market and promote this food. Because, I mean, that's one of the challenges that they're saying, look, you know, it just means we're going to lose more money, basically, if we have to stock more healthy food.
Indeed. Yeah. It seems like there's a lot of, you know, fraught issues attached to this. How many stores are we talking about when we think about Chicago or even Illinois? How many stores would this impact?
Let's see. I believe it's close to about 2,000 in Chicago.
Okay.
That accept stamps. And that's, you know, again, that's everything from Walmart, Costco, to farmers markets, to pharmacies. You know, there's a wide variety of stores.
Yeah, and so a big store like a Walmart or a Costco, it would just be a matter of labeling a greater variety of things.
Exactly. It's no big deal for them. They're probably there already. This is really, it's really the small stores and even the pharmacies. Actually, Walgreens has had a statement. They're concerned about this as well. Retail pharmacies that are smaller footprint stores, they're the most concerned about this.
Very interesting. Greg Trotter, thanks so much for being with us. We will look to you later in the year as these changes start to go into effect, and we will all keep an eye on ChicagoTribune.com for more reporting from you on this topic. Thanks very much.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I think it's a timely issue, given it's, you know, at its core, it's really about, you know, it's a social equality issue.
Yeah, truly.
And so we'll see if the federal rule change, you know, helps sort of level the playing field when it comes to access to healthy food.
Yeah, indeed. It is a very important topic. Thanks very much. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and when we come back, more of this. We're going to be talking about injuries that did not exist even maybe 5 years ago because they're tech related. We'll be talking about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hi, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I hope that you are outside enjoying some of this beautiful sunshine, my friends, because it is lovely. I'm watching everybody walking by here in the Allstate Showcase Studio, and everyone looks smiley and happy in that sunshine. So I hope you are in on that. My friends, still tons and tons and tons to do here today on the Business Lunch Show. Right now, we are joined by Haley Tsukayama, who is a tech reporter at Washington Post, who has written a very interesting story. I hope you go to WashingtonPost.com and check this out for yourself because it is really fascinating. It is about injuries that did not exist about a decade ago, perhaps not even 5 years ago, and that is injuries that are tech-related. And we're talking about things like selfie elbow and texting neck and things like that. So here to talk with us about that. Hi, Haley. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Well, tell us about these injuries, because I think we all know about like tennis elbow and things like that and you know, like golf shoulder, those kind of things that people like commonly have. But these are a whole new crop of injuries that are all about how we're using our devices.
Yes, exactly. They're sort of in the same vein, right? It's repetitive motions that, you know, small motions that we maybe don't think about that often. But if you think about selfie elbow, you actually do have to put your arm in a very awkward, extended position, and you're gripping your phone, and of course you're trying to get that perfect angle, and you have to kind of move your thumb to hit the right button. So there are actually a lot of strange motions that you have to put yourself through. And if you do it over and over and over again, just like golfer's elbow, just like tennis elbow, you end up having you know, these strain injuries in your arm, and they can really hurt.
Well, you know, the selfie elbow, I don't know that I totally get, because, you know, a tennis elbow and things like that, there's an impact part to it, right? Like you're hitting that ball, you're swinging the racket, things like that. Whereas I feel like you'd have to take a whole heck of a lot of selfies to actually injure yourself from straining that hard.
I think that is true. I also think it depends on how hard you're gripping your phone, because, you know, that is a lot of tension to kind of keep it from falling, right, from falling on your face or on the ground or in the ocean, depending on where you're taking the picture. But, yes, you're right. You do have to do it a lot. But, you know, we've also seen this with people's hands, with text thumb, they call it, or some people call it text claw, which I think is a pretty funny, evocative name.
Right.
And I shared in the article, actually, that from typing so much, I have myself shoulder problems. It's just, you know, constant little bits of strain every day. I don't take that many selfies personally, but a lot of people do.
Well, there's nothing wrong with a good selfie.
Nothing wrong with a good selfie, but, you know, believe it or not, stretch and rest are important if you're taking a lot of selfies. So.
Well, and so that was kind of the interesting part of this to me, is it seems like when you injure yourself playing a sport, you kind of know it. You know, you start to know it over time. Every time you swing that racket or that club, you kind of, you know, it's tied in that joint or something like that. But this seems like a very gradual but preventable in a whole different way kind of injury. I mean, you know, and I'm guilty of it too. I use my devices all the time, but you know, you're looking down at your phone for a while doing something or knocking out a few emails, you stop and you just kind of, you know, rub your neck for a second because you notice it. So is there perhaps a degree of non-bodily awareness going as we're very consumed on our devices?
I think that's definitely true. And as you said, you know, with tennis, with golf, you have an impact point. You kind of, in your brain, you think of it as an activity, right? As a thing you're doing, as a physical activity that needs to be prepared for and, you know, that you do need to think of your body. But as you say, these are very little motions that we're taking every day if we're looking down at our phone, if we're, you know, taking selfies. And so you almost don't think of it as an activity. And so in that way, you don't mentally prepare yourself for it.
Right. And then the release of the new Pokemon Go, the mobile take on the classic franchise, it seems like there are some injuries attached to that, too. People are getting Pokemon-related injuries. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, so in the new Pokemon Go, you track. It's actually pretty neat if you grew up with the Pokemon franchise. You can track Pokemon through the app, and then when you're near a Pokemon, you can hold up your phone and see it through the camera. And people get very excited about this. And sometimes they get so excited that they don't notice that they're about to trip over a curb. Or I talked to one person who fell in a ditch and broke their foot.
Wow.
You know, they're just so excited by what they see on the screen that they're not looking up and not taking into account sort of, you know, where they are in the actual world.
That's a little terrifying. We should be on the lookout for people consumed by the Pokemon app because there are things attached to that. Well, this reminds me of, do you remember a couple of years ago, some Eastern European, I want to say it was a Russian government issued, or a government, you know, agency issued some rules about selfies because so many people were getting injured. There was like, don't take selfies with an automatic weapon. Don't take selfies with bears. Don't take them on the edges of mountains, things like that, because people were so focused on taking the selfie, they didn't realize, like, say there was a train or a wild animal or something about to attack them.
Yes. I think there was a viral video that went around of a person taking a selfie in front of a train and they got hit in the head.
Ugh.
I think they ended up okay. I hope so.
I hope.
Yeah, but I think that's definitely true. It's kind of interesting, you know. We all get these devices, and they're very exciting, and they change a lot. But we're never really we are not of a generation where we thought that we had to be trained how to use them. We're just sort of making it up as we go along. And I do think that there has to be some conversation, you know, either with parents or, you know, between people of sort of what the proper ways to use a phone are, and, you know, just common sense. Don't let your tech device override your common sense.
Well, are we seeing these tech-related injuries mostly in young people, or is it pretty well representative, anyone with a device?
So people that I've talked to, particularly the physical therapists, are saying, you know, we're definitely seeing these repetitive strain injuries in younger and younger people, and certainly more so than they've seen in the past. And so it is true that it is mostly young people, which makes sense, right? If you think about it, they grew up with the devices. They probably spend the most time on them. They use them for the widest variety of things. And so, we are seeing it more among young people than among older people.
Sure. I interviewed an ophthalmologist who was talking about this very topic about a year ago, and he said, and he was kind of towards the end of his career, nearing retirement age, and he said, over my career, I have seen people's eyes age sooner and sooner. And he said right now, but now it's even more rapidly happening. And so he said, I'm seeing people in their 30s and 40s with having vision issues that usually aren't addressed for decades after that. So it's, for as much as I am very pro technology, and we talk about that often on this show, it is very interesting to see the toll it's taking on our physical bodies. I mean, just there are so many tolls that technology is in fact taking, but the devices themselves seem to be striking back just a little bit.
I totally agree. Yeah. And like I said, it's a conversation you think is sort of dumb to have, right? To say to yourself, no, I really have to, think of my eyes and think of my wrist and do wrist stretches, right? It seems kind of silly just because of the way that we've been raised to say, well, I have to do wrist stretches so that I can use my device. But it's really something that we have to think about because people's range of mobility is going down in their arms, right? Because we're using our arms so much, we're gripping our phones so much that actually it for some people it is causing injury and really preventing them from being healthy.
Right. We wouldn't think it's a conversation we need to have with each other, but yet here we are. So let's have that conversation. All right, Haley Tsukayama, thanks so much for being with us. We will continue to turn to you at WashingtonPost.com for this and other stories. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. We're going to get you to news here in just a bit with our good friend Susan Berkus. And when we come back, we are talking about some very big changes in the biotech startup world. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending part of your beautiful Saturday with us. I hope you're enjoying the sunshine as you're hearing this, my friends, because it's super lovely outside. Still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, of course. Many, many topics to dive into. We're joined right now by Andrew Pollack, who is the biotech reporter at the New York Times. And Andrew, you've written this week about some really interesting changes that have been occurring with a particular biotech startup, in particular Elizabeth Holmes, who's the CEO and founder of Theranos. She's been banned from operating a medical lab for 2 years after a series of events happened with her startup. So back us up a little bit and talk to us about what happened leading up to this point.
Well, as you know, or as many readers probably know, Theranos was started by Elizabeth Holmes when she was a Stanford student. She dropped out to start this company, which says it developed ways of testing, doing medical tests using finger pricks of blood rather than the usual tubes of blood that are filled from near your elbow. And this attracted huge attention and a lot of money and gave the company a valuation of about $9 billion, of which her share was worth over $4 billion. So she was at one point considered, at least on paper, the youngest billionaire. But questions have been arising over the last year or so about whether the company's technology works, and there's been a series of unfavorable inspections by government regulators, both particularly about the laboratory they ran, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, which regulates laboratories, found many, many problems in an inspection late last year, and the company has submitted two different attempts to remedy the situation, detailing what they've done, and the government has decided this was not sufficient, that they haven't fixed the problem. So it's imposing very severe sanctions, which is that their main lab in California is going to lose its certification to even operate as a laboratory. It won't be able to accept any payments for services from Medicare or Medicaid, and the owners and operators of that lab, which includes the company and Ms. Holmes as the owner of the company or part owner, will not be able, when this goes into effect, will not be able to own or operate any laboratory for at least 2 years.
So what were the nature of the concerns that regulators found? Was it about the lab environment or the process by which they process blood?
The government looked at a whole host of things. Their main issue, I think, was quality control and assurance. I mean, when you're going to use a machine to do a blood test, you have to make sure it's, say, properly calibrated and gives, you know, consistent and reliable information. And if your tests don't show that it's doing that, then you should not be running patient samples through it.
Certainly.
And giving back the information to their doctors. And so there were violations. Some of them were, you know, using machines that weren't sort of properly set and seemed to be giving aberrant results. Some were not storing samples at the right temperature or not making sure the freezers were at the right temperature. There was insufficiencies in the training of the laboratory personnel. And there were a lot of record keeping and you know, procedures that labs have to go through. If you notice some anomaly, there should be a defined procedure for investigating it and fixing it. And in some cases, Theranos did not have these procedures, or if they did, they did not follow them.
Right. So given all of that, then, what's the kind of the fallout in the next steps here? Because I've got to assume then a lot of test results probably are being called into question with false positives and false negatives and so on, and may, perhaps even a false diagnosis. And so what is that cleanup, and what is the, you know, the next move from them and from regulators?
Well, as far as the patients are concerned, I mean, part of this whole process was for Theranos to show that it had corrected these mistakes and informed the patients. The government is not satisfied that they did that to the fullest extent. Theranos did either void the results of a lot of tests taken from, you know, a year or two ago, or they sent corrected results to some patients for tests. One can question how useful that is if you find that, you know, the test result you got 2 years ago is no longer valid. I'm not sure how much use that is to a patient now. But Theranos says that to their knowledge, no patient has been harmed by this. Mm-hmm. So we don't really know what the consequences were.
Right. Well, one in particular, about this time last year, the FDA approved the Theranos test to detect if someone had been infected by herpes simplex virus 1. And I've got to think, even if there was a, perhaps a false diagnosis or something like that. I mean, if you believe you have been infected with something, perhaps you have sought treatment, but certainly something like that, that you would, you know, perhaps there are some, you know, lifestyle alterations and things like that, that you would, there's a psychological impact, I have to think.
Yes. And I think, you know, again, that's the one test that got FDA approval. So, you know, that test is, I'm sure, fairly reliable. And it's a fairly simple test. It's a yes-no test. I mean, one thing that's raised concern about Theranos is they said at the time they got this approval, we're submitting 120 tests to the FDA, and that's a high standard, and we're going to get them all approved. And other than that first one, they haven't had any approved. Yeah. As far as patient impact, the one that concerned the regulators the most is a test for blood clotting that's used for people who are on the blood thinner drug called warfarin. Mm-hmm. And you have to regulate the warfarin dose very carefully. If you have too much of it, your blood gets too thin. You can have bleeding, say bleeding in the brain or somewhere else. And if you don't take enough of the warfarin, then you're not thinning the blood enough, and you're at risk of a blood clot. So people get a very, you know, a test to calibrate how much warfarin they could use. And the government found that, you know, that Theranos was not administering this test properly, and various of these measurements they were giving to patients might have been inaccurate. And that could be very serious. And that is why the government said in one of their inspection reports that some of what they found put patients, I think they used the term, immediate jeopardy.
Mm. Yeah.
So that was the most serious one, immediate jeopardy to patient health and safety.
Yeah, that's immediate jeopardy is immediate jeopardy. That's an important one. Well, thank you so much for breaking all this down for us and giving us this timeline of events and the what's next for your. We will keep turning to you at New York Times for the latest as this story continues to unfold and we see what happens down the road with this company and with this very young billionaire CEO. Andrew Pollack, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and when we come back. We are talking about a local company that the Sun-Times recently profiled that I think you will find terribly interesting. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today. My friends, we have talked a lot on this show about food and food systems and all of the stuff that goes into it and how there's so much we need to do to make accessible food, well, accessible to more people and have a better quality of food and all that. And there is a startup that was recently profiled right here by the Chicago Sun-Times that is all about a compost business, which is a really, really interesting idea. And here to talk about that is the man who runs that business, Jonathan Scheffel. Thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for the interest and having me on.
Well, certainly. It's a topic that I think is very, very interesting and one that we just don't talk about enough. And so tell us about Healthy Soil Compost, the business that you started.
Sure. Healthy Soil Compost is basically a curbside organic recycling program located just in the city, just in Chicago right now. And we service commercial and residential members that want to separate organic waste from ending in a trash can or in a landfill and would rather see it be upcycled into compost or a soil amendment. In our case, we partner with a commercial earthworm farm that's also in the city, and they're called Nature's Little Recyclers, and they produce pure vermicastings, or worm poop, made from every member that's helping to separate their waste.
I think this is definitely the first time worm poop has been said on this show, but I like it. I'm totally on board with it. So tell us about the process, because you know what? I have long said that this needs to exist, because for those of us who live in the city, it's just not practical. We can't compost as much as we might want to believe it. And many of us don't have the, you know, time or necessarily a car to go drive it out somewhere to compost. And a lot of times when you approach somebody, I know many people that have approached people who do compost and they say, no, because I want to make sure the integrity of the compost is just right and nothing wrong is in there. And so, you know, there's a lot of rules people want around their compost. So what is the process if someone, for a residential client, if they want to get in on this program, what is that process for them?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're correct. That's the whole service is here because it's really hard for people to compost in the city. It needs a lot of ingredients. But really, all you need to do for our service is go to our website, healthysoilcompost.com, and you can easily sign up. And then we pretty much just bring you we use 5-gallon buckets from Home Depot, and we line them and have a lid on them, just like a little trash can, and we deliver that to your house or your apartment, or we even work with people in high rises. And then we go from there. They choose a frequency of pickup, either once a week, up to once a month, or even on demand. And then we come by and switch it out with a fresh bucket, just like a personal waste service. And it's real simple and very sanitary and clean. And usually most people say there's no smell.
Well, that was my next question, because the idea of having, a 5-gallon bucket full of food scraps, I think a lot of landlords probably just cringed at the idea of that sitting in an apartment to attract insects or outside on the porch to attract rodents or something like that. And how does that even work?
Yeah, I find it's even cleaner than just a normal trash cans. I mean, we're putting food waste in the trash can mainly. About 60% of what we throw away is organic recycling or a compostable material, and we usually just throw it in the trash. So we're just giving you a different can to put it in. We have lids on the can, so there's usually no problem with fruit flies. And just we recommend having frequent pickups. And then it's always just really a clean pickup, a clean bucket. And I say no to a certain items that you'll hear a lot of composters say no to, like dairy and meat and fish. And those are also things that might turn rancid. And I don't want a member's experience to be lowered because they have rancid meat in their kitchen.
Right. So if you throw it in there, it's your fault. If it smells, yeah, it's
so
your own fault.
We take those materials, but we explicitly say no to them to try to cut down the amount that we get of those materials.
Right. So tell us about the first year of your business, because it seems like you went in, it seems like you, as you've in the story anyway, in the Sun Times, it sounded like you wanted to do this because it was something you believed in and you didn't necessarily have a super high, maybe you were a little bit surprised by how quickly your expectations were surpassed in the first year of your business.
So I've definitely always been into the energy transformation component of composting and how waste can be converted into a raw material for another process. But it was really interesting. And I always kind of second-guessed myself starting, and I still do, thinking, oh, so this is just going to end tomorrow. And this is just kind of too good to be true that more people want to do this. It all started by getting on a website called EveryBlock, and it's sort of a neighborhood forum. And I just started asking people in my neighborhood if they wanted a service like this. And the response actually just kept coming in saying, yes, we would pay for somebody to come pick up our compostable items. And so I just started doing it as a hobby and then created the business after I saw it was working out and a lot of fun.
Well,
it's a lot of work, a lot of hard work, but it's really fun.
Yeah, and such a worthy and important cause, because there's food waste is a really, really big deal in not just our country, but in our world. When some people don't have enough, it's really shameful to be throwing out scraps and the scraps that we do throw out, like peels and things like that, we should be recycling them and not giving them to landfills.
It's a very easy thing to separate and recycle them.
Right.
And to give back to like a local system.
So what about the commercial end of you have a commercial wing of the business too. Is that specifically for food service establishments, or is that for other things too?
It could be for anybody. So we have now a few small offices that just have it in their kitchen to either save coffee grounds or capture coffee grounds. And then I do four restaurants, and those are really for the back of house prep that goes on in the kitchen to separate all that waste that's normally going to the trash. And they were actually able to negotiate lower trash costs because the heavy amount of material, it's all water waste, is now being separated and goes to me, and my service ends up being a little cheaper for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. You're saving businesses.
Really, anybody could be a compost member. And it's really about getting awareness out that this is important and to find a value in it. Most businesses don't really have much financial incentive to add on an expense like composting.
Right.
It's cheaper for most businesses just to use landfill trash because of how the system has been created, especially in Chicago.
Well, I'm super glad to hear that you are trying to change and rework that system. So what is next for Healthy Soil Compost, and where will you be going with the business?
Next would be still continuing a network that I'm trying to communicate with the other compost haulers in the city. There's actually a total of six of us businesses that haul organic waste, and it's really trying to develop a network between them so that we can maybe help one another out or just share ideas and become a strong network. Also, just continuing to improve the business. It's kind of new. I have five cyclists now. We call them soil cyclists. And they're now going around the city in trailers doing their own pickups. And so we're going to keep improving on that and maybe go into some more restaurants or try to sign more people up so that more and more people can be helped. It's a good thing because as our business grows, it's just more bicycles on the street, and we're just doing more positive things for the community.
Definitely. Well, everybody, head to healthysoilcompost.com, and you can read about this organization. And if it's right for your house or your business and you want to do it, there you go. You can sign up right there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jonathan Scheffel, owner of Healthy Soil Compost. And best of luck to you, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
All right, my friends, we're going to get you to news here in just a bit and turn you over to King John back in just a bit on 720 WGN.